Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education, your weekly guide to education matters in Ireland and further afield. You can get in touch with me through Twitter at InsideEd, by email to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie or through the programme's website insideed.com. If you're an educator with a story to tell or an event to highlight, please contact me and I'll do my best to feature it on a future programme. In an interview on this programme over 4 years ago, the former Senator and former General Secretary of the Irish National Teachers Organisation, Joe O'Toole, made the following statement.
If anybody thinks that the government makes no difference to the education system, they are living in cloud cuckoo land. The government make all the decisions on education, not just in terms of money, which is what everybody looks at, but what is taught, how it's dealt with, etc.
As if to support Senator O'Toole's claim, a new book has just been published by the History Press Ireland. Its title is Irish Education, the Ministerial Legacy, 1919 to 1999, and it looks at the legacy of each Minister for Education from the foundation of the state up to the end of the last century. The book's author is Dr. Antonia McManus, and she is my guest on the programme this week. Antonia McManus was a lecturer in the History of Education in the School of Education in Trinity College, Dublin for 20 years. Having spent some time as Director of Teacher Education at Hibernia College, she is currently engaged in full-time research. Her first book, The Irish Head School and its books, 1695 to 1831, was published in 2002. I met up with Antonia McManus recently and I first asked her why she wrote the book.
When I was lecturing for over 20 years on the history of Irish education, it was clear to me that there was a gap there. Nothing had been written on this scale anyway in 25 years. So it was obvious that there was a need. And I wished I had the book myself, to be honest, when I was lecturing. It would have made life a little easier for me.
And to organise it according to legacy, why did you choose that particular route?
To give it a structure, really. To take each minister by minister, spanning 80 years. I just thought it would be much more interesting for the reader.
And how did you go about writing it then?
Well, I had garnered a great deal of material over the 20 years and I was particularly interested in the contributions each minister made. That's really where that came from, because it was perfectly obvious some made really major contributions while others were less significant. Putting it diplomatically, I suppose I was particularly writing with students in mind, thinking, well, this will be a useful book to them when it's written, hopefully. That really was what stimulated me to write it in that particular way.
Because one of the things that I even found difficult before your book was to find a list of all the people who had occupied the position of Minister for Education over the years. Just to get it all together in one place was difficult.
That's exactly it. And that's exactly what I set out to do, to collate what was there already. Because a great deal, actually, of specialised studies have been done since then. Really good work, like Valerie Jones's specialised work on the preparatory colleges and Sean Griffin and Michael Shevlin's book on special education needs. Now, these are not my areas of expertise, but I learned so much from them. And also Mary Raftery and Ono Sullivan's book on the industrial school, Suffer Little Children. And indeed the book on the inspector, a wonderful book by Professor John Coolan and Patrick F. O'Donovan. John Walsh's book, Partnership and Education, and so on and so forth. There were very many of them.
In addition to this work, Antonia was able to draw on autobiographies of ministers such as Mary O'Rourke, Gemma Hussey and Pádraig Faulkner, as well as biographies of ministers for education such as Sean Mylan, Richard Mulcahy, Jack Lynch, Donna O'Malley, Seamus Brennan and Brian Lenehan. But in addition to these books, Antonia drew on other sources.
The National Archives, that was a valuable source. The National Library of Ireland was absolutely fantastic. The Trinity College Library too. I went to official documents, the department's official documents, Shannon reports, Doyle reports ad nauseum, OECD reports until they were coming out of my ears, and so on. So there were primary sources and secondary sources.
And when you think of the responsibility of a minister for education, how do you think they get their heads around it in terms of the scope of the work? Because it is quite a large department.
It is quite a large department, and in the early years, up to the 1960s, the policy was the revival of the Irish language, and education policy and the revival policy became synonymous. So that was easy for them. But now, to be fair to the early ministers for education, they were operating in very different circumstances because there was the War of Independence and the Civil War. I take Owen McNeill, for instance. Like, he was operating literally underground. When deputations came to him, he had to meet them underground. But even during those difficult times, they managed to achieve a great deal. Like, the Ministers and Secretaries Act set up the department in 1924. You had the Intermediate Amendment Act in 1924. You also had the School Attendance Act, the Vocational Education Act. And this now is at a time, 1924, the Irish Catholic described Ireland as being in a pathological state. It was convalescing in the wake of the Civil War and so on. Now, after that, during the 1950s, the economy was stagnant. There was emigration and high inflation and so on. But the Gaelicisation policy still was held sacrosanct. So educational planning, the state of schools, that didn't preoccupy them to any great deal. T.G. O'Connell, he was the General Secretary of the INTO for 32 years, and he was opposition spokesman, Labour opposition spokesman in education, and he had to bring it to the attention of the ministers, the actual dreadful condition of schools. He told them that conditions were indescribable, that schools that should have been centres of learning and enlightenment were often centres of disease and even death. And the maintenance grant for schools was only £2 in the early 1920s, and then in 1925 it increased by £2.01. So education policy making in the early days, they got by on a wing and a prayer, really, for the most part. Planning was not the priority. Gaelicisation was the policy, was the priority.
That explains a lot in terms of turning a blind eye to other things that were going on in the system. But was that coming from the department? Was it coming from the Taoiseach of the day? Or was it coming from the ministers themselves, this aspiration for Gaelicisation?
Well, it lasted for 40 years. John G. O'Kelly was the first minister for Irish.
He also had responsibility for education.
Now, that's noteworthy that there was no minister for education appointed in the first Dáil by Éamon de Valera. And why was that? Because there was opposition to the Macpherson Education Bill at the time.
The Macpherson Education Bill was an attempt by the British government's chief secretary in Ireland, James Macpherson, to propose radical reform of the education system for all of Ireland. It proposed to set up a central department of education, but it met opposition from the Catholic bishops at the time because
there was one proposal that we should introduce local education committees, and they felt that that would undermine the Catholic managerial system in schools. So by August 1921, it was safe to promote J.G. O'Kelly to Minister for Education. But he was the man who introduced reviving the language through the schools. But it was the INTO that took the first initiative to hold a first national programme conference of instruction for the primary schools. And he invited, obviously, J.G. O'Kelly was present. And then there was Professor Timothy Corcoran. He was Professor of Education in UCD, and he advised the conference. And he advised the conference that if children were fully immersed in the Irish language, that they would become fluent Irish speakers, irrespective of the fact that they came from English-speaking homes. Now, he was talking to a very receptive audience, and as a result of the conference, a report was produced. And the report stated that Irish should be used as a medium of instruction in schools, but the controversial one was that infants were to be taught entirely through Irish, with no teaching of English. Now, the INTO signed the report, but had grave reservations about it. Now, the extraordinary thing, Sean, is that this policy was implemented. Kevin O'Higgins said that his Dáil cabinet ministers were the most conservative revolutionaries that ever put through a successful revolution. But the language policy proved the exact opposite. It was radical in the extreme, because they were going to revive the language on a budget of 10,000, even though the British Exchequer paid 5 million for Irish education in 1920. Most teachers were untrained.
Out of 12,000 primary teachers, only 1,100 had the bilingual certificate to teach the Irish language. Not only that,
there were very few textbooks. Irish literature was practically non-existent. There was no standardised spelling, grammar or vocabulary. And as I said, 90% of the children came from English-speaking homes. But actually, school attendance was appalling. It was at 69% compared to 90% in Scotland, or 85% in England. But they were very enthusiastic for the policy. And actually, there was great public support for the policy at this stage. Now, John G. O'Kelly had to leave the Dáil because of he was an anti-treaty Sinn Féin member, along with De Valera, and he was replaced by two ministers. You had Michael Hayes for the Dáil, and you had Finian Lynch for the provisional government. These two guys were only 33 years old, and they were wildly enthusiastic for the revival of the language. And Finian Lynch, on the exact day of the handover of power from the British government to the Irish provisional government, he sent out public notice number 4, which ordered that Irish was to be taught or used as a medium of instruction for at least 1 hour every day in all national schools where there was a teacher competent to teach it, which was fair enough. Following on from that, with our first minister in the Irish Free State was the gentleman I mentioned already, Owen McNeill. Now, Owen McNeill didn't believe in the policy. He thought it was a crazy policy. He wrote in 1893, he said, "No language has ever been kept alive by mere book teaching." And then in 1902, he was writing at the Clive Sulish. He said, "You may as well attempt to put wooden legs on hens as attempt to revive the language through the schools." But what does he do? He felt honour-bound to implement the policy. The man who comes after him is John Marcus O'Sullivan. He can't speak one word of Irish, but he placed teachers under inordinate pressure to gain certificates to teach Irish and bilingual certificates as well. These are teachers under the age of 30, failing which they would have their salary increments withdrawn. But that was deemed to be unlawful by the Supreme Court in 1940, and teachers had their salaries, their increments returned to them. Following on from John Marcus comes an even more zealous language revivalist, who's Thomas Derrick. Thomas Derrick was minister for 15 years in the first Fianna Fáil government from 1932 to 48. And he knew the policy had failed. But what does he do? He undertakes the revival with almost missionary zeal. And he introduces the 1934 revised programme of primary instruction, which is actually a ruthless attempt to revive the language, because he lowers the requirement in other subjects in order that teachers may concentrate on teaching Irish. And he allowed English to become an optional subject for first-class children, and rural science was made an optional subject, and requirements in arithmetic were lowered. So the upshot of that was totally predictable, that standards would plummet, which they did. 90% of schools ceased teaching rural science in an overwhelmingly agricultural country. So De Valera and Derrick, they decided that they would make the primary certificate examination compulsory examination in Irish, English and arithmetic, written examinations, even though the stated policy was to revive Irish as a vernacular language. And the INTO were weary of this.
That was because they had been calling for an inquiry into the Irish language, but when none was forthcoming, they set up their own inquiry in 1941. The inquiry found that the language policy was placing a mental strain on children.
That it was educationally regressive and that it was not acceptable to most Irish parents. In fact, parents were getting their children to request English readers from their teachers so that they could be given in the home the English instruction denied them in the schools. So Derrick didn't react to the report for a year. And when he did react, he and De Valera were singing off the same hymn sheet on this one, because they both said that the reports of the inspectors were very much more to be relied upon. Following on from Thomas Derrick was Richard Mulcahy, who was Minister for Education in the two inter-party governments.
He was a Fine Gael minister.
Fine Gael minister, absolutely. Now, Richard Mulcahy, in retirement, told his son when he was recording his memoirs, he said, "I didn't believe in the Irish language policy, but I was caught for a way out." It actually took until 1960 when Patrick Hillary, a 36-year-old minister for education, introduced Circular 1160. Now, Circular 1160 gave teachers the freedom to choose between teaching through the medium of Irish or teaching Irish conversation. So that basically was the end of the rule that you're to teach infants through Irish. But the damage was done really at that stage, because...
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, because it's not just the damage that's been done, but it's just such a hypocrisy that seems to have been part of the ministerial culture, and presumably then the department, for so many years. Because people who knew that it wasn't working, or people who themselves weren't competent, expecting teachers to be competent in the language.
Precisely, and they tended to blame the teachers. You know, the teachers weren't patriotic, or they were over-reliant on books. But children paid a high price for this, Sean, because there was doctoral research conducted by Father John McNamara from St. Patrick's Training College, and his conclusions were that there was a disproportionate amount of time being spent teaching Irish to the detriment of English, and that Irish children were 17 months behind their English counterparts in written English and 11 months behind in problem arithmetic. The reason, Sean, I think that the ministers went hell bent on this policy is because they all refused to set up an education inquiry. They couldn't afford to reveal that the policy had failed, because that would mean the failure of their chief nationalist aim. And nationalism was everything, and being the Fianna Fáil and Cumann na Gael, they were vying with one another who was the most patriotic and who would, you know, literally that's the way it was. They couldn't concede failure.
And was it reinforced by the officials in the department and by the inspectors?
Well, absolutely. The inspectors placed teachers under great pressure. The system of inspection, Sean, it was called a rating system of inspection. There are three grades. You had efficient, highly efficient, and not efficient. One in three teachers got the highly efficient grade, and they were entitled to a salary higher than their colleagues. In fact, it was a restricted category. Teachers who got the highly efficient grade would have to wait until another teacher resigned, retired, or died. Now, gradually, this rating system was phased out. It was actually Richard Mulcahy who got rid of the highly efficient rating. And it was Jack Lynch, the young 40-year-old Cork man, who became Minister for Education in 1957. He thought the grading system was absolutely atrocious, because even in his maiden speech on the Dáil in 1948, he was quite amusing actually, he understood the deep suspicion with which inspectors were held. And he said, you know, these inspectors, they scoop down from the clouds, he said, on the poor, unfortunate teachers. And he said they go around like spies instead of inspectors. So he totally abolished the rating system of inspection. And it did actually result in more cordial, harmonious relations between teachers and inspectors.
I'm still wondering, though, is it an oversimplification to say that the main priority of the department and of the ministers in the first, say, 30 or 40 years was Gaelicisation? I mean, like, were they paying attention at all to school buildings? Were they paying attention to third level education? Were they interested in even post-primary education?
No, they weren't interested. Well, look, they didn't have the funding either, but they didn't show any keen interest in providing, we'll say, pre-second level education. Now, Owen McNeill did provide secondary education in what were called secondary tops, that is, primary schools that were allowed to provide the secondary school curriculum, and that's in the early 20s. The others simply didn't consider free second level education. Thomas Derrick had actually two opportunities to do it. In 1934 and 1946, the vocational schools were established in 1930.
But by 1933, there was dissatisfaction with the vocational schools. The Secretary of the Department of Education, Joseph O'Neill, said they weren't providing an adequate general level of education, and nor were they directing students' attention towards an agricultural life, even though they were never set up for that purpose.
So what does he decide to do? He decides to introduce senior schools into 21 Gaeltacht areas, and Derrick, a young minister, approved wholeheartedly, and so did De Valera. And they attempted to introduce these senior schools, which would offer a practical education free of charge in these 21 Gaeltacht areas. They even had a plan to provide free transport by supplying free bicycles and waterproof clothing. Now, the Department of Finance, when it heard this news, this plan, treated it with derision and said, bicycles for pupils in new schools will disappear frequently. Accident riding department machines. They thought this was just hilarious. But actually, the Catholic bishops held their meeting in October 1934 and objected to these senior schools on the grounds that it would undermine the managerial system and would lead to an increase in state control. And they were worried about the moral risks involved for 12 to 16-year-olds coming long distances to school without supervision. So that didn't happen then, which was a pity, but it could have happened. It really could have happened in the 1940s, because you had free second level education in the north of Ireland in 1947 and in the UK since the height of the Second World War in 1944. So there was a reasonable expectation that Derrick and De Valera would actually introduce free second level education. De Valera wanted it and placed enormous pressure on Derrick to do so, but it was coming towards the end of his political career, unfortunately. And he did get as far as setting up a departmental committee from 1945 to 47, and they did recommend free comprehensive style education for those aged 12 plus. Could have happened. No report was published. Fianna Fáil were out of office in 1948, and there ended a golden opportunity to provide it. So can you imagine what that would have meant in 1947 if they had free second level education? But we had to wait a further, not until 1967, further 20 years.
That's right. Yeah. And I suppose that's probably one of the most famous legacies is Donough O'Malley's. His legacy was free post-primary education.
Right.
But it took some nimble footwork for him to set the policy in motion.
It did take some nimble footwork for him to set the policy in motion. But then he had a great mentor in Sean Lemass, who guided his young ministers. I mean, in fact, I think free education, you can thank three ministers for it, not one. Patrick Hillary, George Colley, and Donough O'Malley, they had a social conscience. And I know they were forever saying, we are going to provide equal educational opportunities for all the children, cherishing all the children of the nation equally. And that was Sean Lemass's belief as well, straight out of the proclamation.
On the 23rd of May 1963, Patrick Hillary made an important policy statement on education. In it, he said his priority was for the one-third of children who never get to go to a second-level school.
Possibly because they can't afford the fees for second level, possibly because there isn't a school available to them. He called them the modern third estate, whose voice amidst the privileged has hitherto been scarcely heard. So in his announcement on the 20th of May, he announced the introduction of comprehensive education, of a common intercert, and now those two combined would eventually break down the social barriers between the vocational schools and the fee-paying private secondary schools. And he also announced the introduction of regional technical colleges, which meant that those children could advance for the first time to third-level technological education. Now, we did other things as well, which were very important. But following on from that, George Colley came in. He was only there from 1965 to 66, but he loved the Ministry for Education and he longed for it and he got it. And he was very enthusiastic about comprehensive education. He said, this will break down the snob value between the vocational schools and the secondary schools. And he came up with the idea, well, let's provide comprehensive education for all second-level students. Now, he tried it, so he wrote a very diplomatic letter to the school authorities of the vocational schools and the secondary. And he suggested to them that they would share resources, share teaching staff. It worked to a certain extent. But what he did do was, he introduced the first three comprehensive schools and he introduced the common intercert in 1966. So he prepared the way. But actually, Jack Lynch did a good bit too, to be perfectly honest, because he pointed out the problem with post-primary education. He said, it's split, he said. There's no coordination. You have vocational schools going this way, you have secondary schools going that way and operating in splendid isolation. He said, what you need to do was to enhance the vocational schools. And that there lay the kernel of the problem, because the vocational schools, they were viewed as second-rate schools, just dead-end schools for dead-end kids, because they only took students from 14 for their vocational education and 16 plus for their technical education. Jack Lynch identified the problem and Patrick Hillary took it from there. There was great continuity, because Jack Lynch belonged to a new generation of ministers, reforming ministers. They didn't equate education policy and Irish policy. And he brought in very, very, very good reforms, which I doubt if he gets very much credit for.
And was Patrick Hillary the first of those reforming ministers in the Department of Education?
I would say that Jack Lynch was. Now, he was limited insofar as, gosh, the economy was literally on its knees. But he lifted the marriage ban on married women teaching. That had been introduced in 1933. Ministers had been asked, could they not? There was a severe shortage of female teachers. And they were asked by the Department of Finance, well, and the INTO, could you not remove this ban on married women teaching? And they said, no, they didn't want to ideologically, this was a good policy. Why did they want the marriage ban introduced? They gave three reasons for it. They said women cannot with full attention serve both home and school. Two salaries coming into one house causes unfavourable comment, and the later months of pregnancy occasion unhealthy suspicion. They were the reasons given. I know that wasn't out of kilter with the thinking at the time, no, it has to be said. But I mean, Jack Lynch was only 40 years old. He didn't have those hang-ups about married women teaching, far from it. In fact, he did an awful lot that was very reforming. He introduced the oral Irish for Leaving Cert. He introduced selection tests for, interviews for prospective teachers. And he insisted that the junior assistant mistresses, that they were the untrained teachers in the system, that they would be trained And they were, not immediately. But he was taking his guidance from the Council of Education report and from the INTO. He listened to the professionals, and he was the one who started the research-based policies, really, because the Council of Education, for all the times it's been criticised because it was conservative, it did say that the pupil-teacher ratio is really very, very high and specified a particular number that was acceptable, and also specified that teachers should be trained. They should not be in a system. But the numbers at that stage were very, very high that were untrained.
It's interesting what you're saying there about Jack Lynch listening to the INTO and listening to the professionals and kind of getting into the research-based education, because it was much later before ministers appointed their advisors. John Boland, I think, was one who introduced that.
He was. He did introduce that. He came in for terrible criticism, poor John Boland.
This is in the early 80s.
Yeah, the 80 to 81, that's right. And that was continued, actually, by Gemma Hussey, because it was quite a novel thing to do, but they thought, heavens, what is he doing here?
What the advisor, John Harris, was doing was trying to implement the vision of an ambitious Minister for Education, John Boland. In the early 1980s, John Boland had a vision of Ireland as the Silicon Valley of Europe. His goal was to prepare girls and boys for
what he called the technological revolution that was underway. And he wanted to equip students with computers in every school in the country, but unfortunately he didn't have the money to do so. But fast forward 30 years, Sean, and you have Micheál Martin was Minister for Education in 1997. He was Minister for Education and Science. The department had been renamed, and he had access to a 250 million scientific and technological education investment fund. And hey presto, he was able to equip every student in the country with a computer, which was wonderful, of course. But even in the late 60s, 69, Brian Lenihan got into terrible trouble, because he declared, much to the dismay of teachers, that education has never been adequately geared to the economy. Fast forward 30 years to Micheál Martin. What does he do? He goes into a business and education partnership with Mary Harney, Taoiseach and Minister for Enterprise, Trade and Employment. And they set up an expert group on future skills needs. And in the foreword to the first report of the expert group, Micheál Martin writes, reminding teachers of the role they have to play and workers in preparing students and workers with the skills, giving them the skills required to participate fully in the knowledge economy. There were no dissenting voices. It's extraordinary how things change.
An interesting reminder from recent Irish educational history of the importance of timing in politics, bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. I'll bring you the second part of my conversation with Antonia McManus on next week's programme. Remember, you can listen to or download over 200 podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.